Well, hey there, freaks. It's your boy Marty Bent here to introduce this week's sponsor before our conversation with David Bailey from BTC Media. This week's episode of Tales from the Crypt is brought to you by the Cash App, the number one finance app in the app stores for the last 2 years straight, freaks. And that is because they are allowing you to do a lot of things. First off, they got the Boost program. You sign up for the Cash App, you get your cash tag, you sign up for the Boost program, and then you get this card sent to you, a Visa card that you can customize. You can put your signature on it, you can put a Bitcoin symbol on it, you can put a lightning bolt on it, whatever you feel fit. You get that card, and then they have deals with merchants like Chick-fil-A, Whole Foods, local coffee shops, Taco Bell. The list goes on. It's only growing. Where you go, you turn your Boost on, you use the card, you save money, and you can use that money to stack sats. Cash App is also the first P2P payments app to let you freaks buy Bitcoin. As you know, they're helping us stack sats on Saturdays, any day, really. So go to your local app store, or the Google Play store, or the Apple App store. Download the Cash App today. Hope you enjoy this conversation with David Bailey, a man who's been very mysterious to me. We hopped into a lot of talk about the early days of Bitcoin, the people who have come and gone as figureheads in the Bitcoin space, and how they are treated these days, and looking forward to the Bitcoin 2019 conference in San Francisco in a few weeks. So if you freaks are looking to go to that, use the code RHR for some discounted tickets. And then, yeah, check out the website, smash that subscribe button, share the podcast, rate, review, trying to blow this thing up. You know you guys are going to enjoy this, because I did as well. What is up, freaks? Welcome back to Tales from the Crypt. It's your boy Marty Bent coming to you from the dopest hotel room I've ever been in my life. We're in Midtown Manhattan. This is truly decadent and incredible. I'm sitting down with a very special guest, somebody who I was just explaining to. I've heard a lot of rumblings through the grapevine throughout the years, but I've never really met or got good information on. So I'm very excited for this conversation. I'd like to introduce you freaks to the founder of BTC Media. You probably know them if you've been reading Bitcoin Magazine over the years, David Bailey. David, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you for having me.
Thanks for coming through, dude. Like I said, Bitcoin man of mystery in my mind. I've heard rumblings throughout the years. So I'm just excited for this conversation in particular because you were around pretty early on. So you've seen a lot change. The way this starts on Tales from the Crypt is, how did you get to come to Bitcoin and start BTC Media?
Yeah, and well, I guess I'll start with this hotel room. It is very dope. It has a very oligarch-like feel. We're not paying for it, all right? So that's the key thing. So Bitcoin. Got started in Bitcoin in college. Found Bitcoin. Somebody sent me an article about the Silk Road. I thought it was a scam. I have like a compulsive personality type, so I started by trying to prove it was a scam. Whole list of reasons why it can never work, one by one, cross them off, get to the point, I don't know why it can't work. I buy my first Bitcoins.
What were
2012, just under $10.
What were those reasons that you were looking to check off the list?
Oh, man. I don't even remember now. The basic shit that all the people who are new to Bitcoin think, like, oh, the government will never allow it, and you know, no one uses gold as a transaction mechanism. You know, clearly the what they're promising technology-wise, there's no way that that can be possible. Just someone who knows nothing and who has exposure to the financial markets and just thinks you're not going to have an unregulated product like this that actually gains any traction.
So was there anything in particular that sort of incepted your aha moment? I was like, oh.
Well, I don't know how much time you've spent on the Bitcoin talk forums.
Yes.
But it is a very, very interesting cesspool of people.
Mm-hmm.
And so I just rabbit-holed hard on Bitcoin Talk. And like for every question you can possibly think of, there's a thread with 1,000 posts on it, probably still being debated to this day for any question you can think of. So, you know, little by little, I was just like, wow, this is actually pretty baked. And, you know, the weird thing about Bitcoin is like when you look at an investment, typically the more you know about it, you find all the warts. You find like all the things that are not good about it, all the hidden things that, you know, you want to gloss over, whatever. Bitcoin's the opposite. You see all the warts to start with. And it's only like once you start digging into it, you see the inner beauty, which I guess that sounds cheesy, but truly it gives its worst face first. which is like the opposite of every investment I've ever looked at ever. So, you know, as you kind of look more and more, you just become more, fall more in love, I guess.
No, it's a very common theme here on Tales from the Crypt. And it's, I love that you said it's, it presents its warts, its ugliness, like abruptly, like right in front of you, 10 minute block times, very few transactions per second. You got to wait for a certain amount of blocks before you can have a degree of certainty that your UTXO is buried into the chain far enough. And, this is something that, so coming from like the traditional financial background, this is something that we talk a lot about on this show, is trying to have the people from traditional finance come to these aha moments, but it seems hard. Like there's a natural like mental barrier for most people. So yeah. Is there anything like philosophically growing up?
I was lucky because, so I got into investing when I was in middle school. I started with $7,000 in the stock market. Turned it into $250,000 while I was in high school.
Boss.
Yeah, felt like a badass.
What were you trading?
Mostly all the things that somebody my age would like. Oh, Apple, that's cool. I should get that. Google, that's cool, which is just like, you know, lucky. But it was a good time to be buying stocks. And then the financial crisis came, and I lost a fortune. Like, of my 250K, I don't even want to tell you what percentage of it I lost, but it was very bad. It was winter pricing. And I had bought a lot of banks. Once the bank started going down, I'm listening to the news, you know, thinking I'm a financially literate, and every bank CEO is like, oh, everything is peachy. And, you know, some of the stocks I bought down 95%, 98%. I mean, just horrendous. And so I went on this quest to kind of find out, how did everyone miss this? And it turns out not everyone did miss it. And that was surprising to me. Like, why was that not covered more? This led me down the path to discovering Austrian economics. I'm very lucky that I'm in Alabama. We have the Mises Institute in Alabama, which is the biggest Austrian think tank that I really think in the world, but definitely in the United States. So I was, that's at Auburn University, so I was able to be exposed to that. And then at the same time, my current CTO and I were running a nonprofit that did microlending. I don't know if you know much about microfinance, but basically writing financial products to people who are unbanked. And so we were doing that in the Black Belt of Alabama, which is the poorest part of the United States. And so we just happened to be in this like right place, right time of, you know, understanding how shitty the financial system is for most people, understanding how broken financial markets were generally, then also at the same time discovering radical free market economics, like radical. And it's like all of those things were infusing right at the right moment. And then my friend sends me an article, have you seen this Bitcoin thing? So it's just luck.
Natural. Yeah, no. That's another big topic on this show is Austrian economics. I was an econ major in college too, and it's funny, you go through at least in today's American university system, if you're studying economics in particular, you go through 4 years of school, you get a degree which is supposed to represent a well-rounded understanding of the subject that you just studied, but it turns out you're only learning one facet of that school or one school of thought within a huge overarching theory that is economics, or not even theory, a study which is economics.
And you got to love the beauty of like the circular logic, just default rates. Oh, zero. That's going to be our operating thesis for how we're going to measure risk on bonds. And somebody's like, that doesn't just rationally doesn't make sense. It's like, oh, well.
Well, it's like there's a detachment from reality going on. So you talk about like default rates. You can talk about CPI working, sort of manipulating the unemployment rates by not taking participation rate and consideration, stuff like that. It seems like the traditional financial world is becoming more and more detached from reality by the decade. Bitcoiners would argue it's a product of monetary policy getting out of hand. Are you somebody who...
Totally.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's interesting. If you look at, like, the Soviet Union, how did the Soviet Union get to where it was? How did no one see the Soviet Union collapsing even just a couple years before it collapsed? It's like they have to distort truth in order to perpetuate the status quo of what they're doing. And so, you know, if inflation is going to challenge what you're doing, you change the definition of inflation so that there is no inflation. And it's just like these word games that are ridiculous. Yeah, totally. Totally.
It's something we've got a couple guests in the room right now, but something the guest to my left, Dwayne, and I were talking about at lunch earlier today was what were we? What the hell was I just about to go to? Were we,
we were talking about disconnect from reality. Austrian economics. All right, I forget that. We were talking about only knowing that you're going through a crisis in retrospect. Mm. So that's what I said. We could be going through something bad that we look back in retrospect. It's like, oh, yeah, it's obvious. Things were wrong. Like, Bitcoin was the obvious answer. So to us, it seems like obvious that...
Oh, totally. That's happening right now, mm-hmm. for sure. I mean, people who lived in the Dark Ages didn't call it the Dark Ages.
Exactly.
Like, if you were a serf, you didn't realize you were a serf. It takes detachment from that environment in order to be able to identify it. So, like, I'm a big believer that we live in a modern Dark Ages. And, you know, instead of the Catholic Church dictating what knowledge is, we have, you know, the federal government and our institutions that really control the source of knowledge and people's access to power, et cetera. And, you know, back in the day, if you wanted to be an up-and-coming man of the world and have some influence, you became I don't know if the priest is the right word, but you entered into the Catholic Church and it was a political apparatus. And, you know, we've just recreated that system. It's a modern day of serfdom, except now the farm that you live on is much larger. So, you know, as long as you don't go across the border, you're okay. But otherwise, you got to make sure you're paying your taxes every year to the fiefdom.
To the fiefdom. Yeah, we're debt slaves right now, debt serfs.
That's right.
And so are you optimistic or pessimistic about the future of this debt fiefdom that we find ourselves in?
Well, I'm incredibly optimistic. Incredibly optimistic. The most bullish time maybe in the Dark Ages was the best time to find opportunities, because after the Dark Ages, you have the Enlightenment era, all mm-hmm. right? Like, it can only get better, right? So I think the next 100 years are going to be incredible. And, you know, I see, you know, the computer and the internet is like our modern printing press. And when you had the printing press, 1300s, people could actually read the shit that they were being told. All right, that changed a lot of minds. And then you couple with that, and I don't think these are coincidences, you have the double entry accounting system emerge at basically the exact same time the printing press emerges. And now you liberate the financial interactions between people. And so for the first time, you're able to have companies and the trading empires that are able to, you know, trust strangers effectively, not be just family-owned enterprises. So I think crypto, specifically Bitcoin, that's our triple entry accounting system. And so I think those two things mirrored together, they bring in a new golden age. They liberate people to go and create value independent of the institutions that formerly enslaved them. And it doesn't in a way where it's not like a revolution where we have to go wave guns in the street. We just make the old system irrelevant. It's like what, you know, Uber did to taxis. It's just like no one even cares. It's just made irrelevant.
No, it's it reminded me of one of my favorite quotes from a Bitcoiner, Neil Woodfine. Shout out, Neil. If Bitcoin does become
Blockstream.
Successful.
Neil, yeah. All right, cool.
Yeah, if Bitcoin does become successful, it will usher in the next enlightenment because it forces people to think about monetary policy, philosophy, computer science, mathematics, game theory. Sort of forces people to think.
I don't know. I'm less maybe bullish on people. I think they like to be lazy. I don't blame them. It's nice. But, you know, you think about it, like half the planet doesn't have a bank account. You know, how many Jack Ma's of the world are rice farmers right now? Because they just lack access to basic financial tools that if they had them, they would be building the next amazing breakthrough technology. So literally, right on its face, half of human potential is just lost. Because these people are not able to plug into the system in which they're able to socially cooperate and create value, truly.
Yeah. And so Bitcoin opens up this opportunity now. And
absolutely.
So what types of innovations that obviously there's an opportunity cost to living under the monetary and financial system that we do now, which can be sanctioned, can be censored, can basically wipe somebody off, deplatform people if they wanted to. Now to a Bitcoin world where not only that is not possible, but now anybody with a cell phone and you don't even need an internet connection anymore. You just need to be able to connect to a node connected to a satellite or something.
Hey, or send smoke signals. Yeah. So I think that's the interesting question. What does the world look like when all of these people are plugged in and they actually have some sort of skin in the game? and some mechanism in order to impact change. I don't know. That's what more people should be focusing on, and think it's going to be quite the movie to watch. You know, the Dark Ages, kind of the overthrow of the Catholic Church, was mostly peaceful. But there were a couple people who had to be burned at the stake also during that time. So I think if you give a lot of people knowledge and power to take care of their own economic freedom, there's going to be a little bit of drama.
Period of tumult, if you will.
Yeah.
No, that's this is going like straight into like the sovereign individual theory. Like they talk about the 500-year super cycles, and the last inflection point was the printing press that destroyed the church. And as you've been describing, the inflection point that we've been born into is the internet and Bitcoin coupled together. And it's crazy being born in that inflection point, right?
In that. We're so lucky. I mean, it's like incredible that we have like a front row seat, and not just a front row seat. Like we're getting to direct the movie too, which is just, I mean, dude, so special,
but it's scary too, right? It's just like rip your face off pace of change. It's scary for a lot of people. It feels like society is like trying to grasp the hold on to how fast things are changing.
Yeah. I mean, you know, so I look at kind of like three different points in history, and I'm sure you could go back further in this, but you have the emergence of writing. At the same time, you have the emergence of basically the single entry accounting system and a form of money, and like society is born. And then fast forward to the printing press and to the double entry accounting system, and we go from like feudal society to where we are today. And it's like, you know, just think about how big of a change that has been. Like, I mean, it's if you gathered all of the artisans together at the time and you said, imagine what the GDP of the world will be in the year 2100. They couldn't even fathom one building, one cell phone that sits in someone's pocket was beyond the total aggregate comprehension of all people. And so it's just like, wow. I mean, we're not creative enough to even know what, you know, 100 years from now can look like in this world. It's going to be amazing.
All right. Are we going to space?
Absolutely. You know, I think it would be really cool, quite poetic, if Bitcoin becomes the mechanism by which we finance space exploration, in the same way that when we had the double entry accounting system, shortly thereafter we have the first stock issuance, first joint stock companies, mm-hmm. and then we have the first stock market just like 100 years later. And that financed ship exploration, and that's how the Dutch went from a tiny little rock to literally like running the world. And then they basically took over England with, you know, William of Orange going over, marrying into the family. So it's like that was like a new technology that enabled like the discovery of a new world. It'd be cool if Bitcoin could do the same.
No, it was it reminds me of a piece that a man named Connor Brown wrote last week, sort of arguing with the naysayers who say Bitcoin has no intrinsic value, so therefore it can't be valuable or useful at all, and comparing it to other stores of value like real estate and gold in particular, which have little intrinsic value. But basically, Bitcoin opens up the opportunity where people do not have to store their value in something like land or gold, and then basically allows for a better allocation of capital because people aren't worried about using their gold or their houses as stores of value. Instead, you can open up gold to create machinery that can take us to space, that can go mine asteroids and stuff like that. So we were talking about the opportunity cost of people not being part of the financial and internet world now. That's just one aspect of it. Like, think about like another aspect is opening up capital to be allocated in a different way, which leads for probably more efficient, better investments in the long run.
Totally. You know, it's you know, humans in general suffer from such a lack of creativity. And, you know, you talk to any economist or any person who comes from the powers that be, and all they see is projection of the status quo and things getting worse. So it's like, you know, any day now, there's going to be population decline. You know, any day now, we're going to have just rampant stagnation, et cetera. It's like, you know, I think the population is going to explode. Like, we start putting people in space, give them the mechanism to create value, make money. Like, we're going to have 100 trillion people in 100 years from now. Like, and it's going to be, you know, a whole new set of people saying this is the end. We're going to not have any more growth. But dude, I mean, I think just the continuation of what we've seen for the past 10,000 years is probably the same thing that we're going to see going forward for the next 10,000 years.
Yeah, we're pretty adaptable as a species, aren't we?
Unbelievably so. Unbelievably so.
Yeah. It's, again, going back to like the pace of change, seeing how, like you were saying, there's naysayers who are like doom and gloom, like, oh, the world's going to end, the world's going to end. And, technology has changed drastically throughout my parents' lifetime. Like, they remember the world without the internet, and obviously now with the internet. And it was a big meme when the internet first came out and the iPhones came out. I was like, the parents aren't going to be able to use this technology. Lo and behold, my mom's using an iPhone, texting, using Snapchat, all that stuff. But even more importantly, I look at my 3-year-old nephew who can barely read, but he knows how to open his mom's iPhone, find pictures of himself, find videos. Like, it's just the world is becoming more sort of innately digital for a new generation.
If you could go back 40 years and tell people we'd have 3-year-olds running supercomputers 40 years later, people would be like, you need to go to the crazy house.
Right.
Bullshit. Yeah. I think the future is unbelievably bright. And I, you know, one of the cool things about Bitcoin that I've always thought was super promising, and we really haven't seen that much of it, I actually wish this would come back into the narrative in a big way, but is machine to machine transactions.
Machine payable web, baby.
Yeah. And so, like, what happens when, you know, machines are able to start growing and building the economy around us, and then human activity is really just a minority subset of all economic activity? I mean, that's a world that no one's really spending much time thinking about, but that's going to happen for sure.
That's a heavy thought. Most economic activity not coming from humans, right?
Yeah. Well, it's probably kind of already like that in some senses. I know, you know, what's interesting about money is, like, I feel like people, they ascribe the wrong purpose to money. Like, money is a tool to enable social coordination. That's all it is, in a decentralized way. So all of us think that we're free agents, like, roaming around, but we all suffer from the same innate wants, desires, greed, etc. And so we have things that are prices that are purely a construct of people's demand for certain goods, etc. And they tell people what to go do. So, hey, if I can do something cheaper than the price that's presented, I can go do it and make money, and I can satisfy all the wants that I have. And so there's, like, this invisible hand that's instructing people what to go do, and they think they're in control of themselves, but their greed is driving them to go do what they do. It's like, you know, already so much of what people do is outside of their control. It doesn't really scare me that much that if machines are doing activity, it's outside of, you know, human control, so to speak.
You talked about, like, tapping into greed. Bitcoin's incentive system is a perfect vehicle to tap into human greed.
Totally.
And it's beautiful to see how perfect it is. Like, the incentive between the stakeholders of users, miners, developers, full node operators, whatever it may be. But we found over the first decade of this technology that it is able to have, like, an emergent distributed sort of consensus and basically growth strategy where it's like, hey, everybody's looking out for their best interests. Everybody's being as greedy as possible. And that's just what makes Bitcoin work.
So I can get pretty far out there on some stuff.
Let's
so,
go. You know, let's go.
But, like, people wonder, like, how did inorganic matter become organic matter? And I feel like what we're watching right now is, like, the analog world moving to the digital world. And we're watching this formation of this new organism. And you ask yourself, like, you know, how do all of these individual cells in your body somehow coordinate together to express a singular thought? Like, where does that consciousness arise from? And it's like, all right, well, when you look at the price of any good, you have millions and millions of individual actors that are all completely independent of each other, but they're all operating by the same rules of the system, so to speak. And then they express this one distinct price. That's just this message that's then broadcast to all the different people who can see that price, have access to that price. It's like, maybe that's how consciousness forms. Like, maybe that's how all of our individual cells somehow come together in this ecosystem of your body and express one human unit. You know, I don't know. I think it's I think there's a lot of parallels. There's a lot of parallels.
There is. It's one of my favorite parallels is, what is it when the group of birds is flying together? A murmur? Is it the murmur?
A flock?
A flock. Well, when they're flying together, but they turn in unison very quickly. I think it's a murmur. When it's a bunch of like swallows, or not even swallows, but a bunch of blackbirds flying, it is a murmur. But that is like what Bitcoin is. Just it's sort of people reacting in the moment with each other because they're forced to sort of act as one unit to make sure that everybody's in consensus at any given point in time. I think I like to look at nature for something like murmurs, like beehives, like another sort of like natural hive mind, if you will, pun intended, for the bees. And Bitcoin sort of helping humans coordinate in that way, because right now you're saying the price is the mechanism that sort of signals to the market how everybody's valuing everything, but the pricing mechanism of the money that we use is centrally coordinated and is not natural at all.
It distorts. It gives all the wrong signals to everyone, so people go do the wrong things.
Mm-hmm.
So what we need is an unbiased form of value so that everyone's using the same yardstick to determine what is the best practical, valuable use of their time. And if we had that, people would be immensely more productive. I mean, people wouldn't be toiling. I mean, this is something that's crazy. There's 1 billion people on the planet that make less than $1 a day. There's 2 billion people on the planet that make less than $2 a day. All right. I think it's 80% of the population of the planet makes less than $10 a day. $10 a day. You're telling me that 6 billion, 5 billion people on this planet can't figure out how to do something that's more productive than $10 a day, and we got assholes on the city of New York doing nothing, making $50 a day. All right, that's insanity. It's insanity, and it's not like those people are any different in terms of their intelligence or their ability or their smartness. This is completely a circumstance of where they were born, you know, what shit into the stick they got. But you know, it doesn't have to always be that way. I think that's what Bitcoin enables. It's a system without any privilege, where the person in the middle of nowhere has the same economic capacity to create value as the person in, you know, downtown San Francisco. And, you know, people are greedy. They're going to create value if they can. Everyone wants a better life. There's no one who doesn't like dream of a better future, you know?
No, I think people in that 80% that you describe making less than $10 a day are probably more motivated and more driven than anybody too.
Absolutely.
Right?
Absolutely.
Mm. It's just giving them, like, that's one of my favorite TED Talks of all time, is the guy who drops like a computer in the middle of India in some poor village, and literally anybody who wanted to come up and use a computer could use it. What you found is like the 6 to 10 year olds taught themselves English and quantum physics like within like 3 weeks.
Dope. Cool.
So that's just one example of information being basically opened to a population where it was never opened before. And they were talking about, like, again, 6 to 12 year olds were able to teach themselves a language and then a science within like a couple of months because they were just so thirsty for knowledge.
Totally.
Yeah. So is a lot of this what drives what you guys are doing at BTC Media? Why did you start BTC Media? Is this to...
So we started BTC Media by accident. Okay. All right. So basically got into Bitcoin. Price of Bitcoin goes way up. First bubble, I guess, that I really experienced. It goes up to 260. And I'm like, all right, I should really evaluate whether this is something I want to invest a lot more time in. And I went to the Bitcoin San Jose Bitcoin 2013 conference. The dopest, coolest thing to this day I've ever been a part of. Really one of the most special moments I've ever seen. Just the immense amount of everyone having this shared recognition that like what is about to happen is a really big deal, and like we have to be the ones to build it. And like everyone is like, you know, you walk into the room at like 2 a.m. in the hotel lobby and there's like 15 different groups of people huddled up in like 3 or 4 people, and they're like conspiring together, and it's just the coolest. It was the coolest thing. But I went to this event, and there's, you know, Google engineers and Apple engineers and Adobe engineers, and they're all pretending that they're sick, or they're all making up excuses why they're not at work because they don't want their boss to know that they've snuck out to go to a Bitcoin conference, because at this time Bitcoin's still not really a kosher thing to talk about. And, you know, they're all talking about what they're spending their weekends on building, and look at this cool nifty thing. And it's like, all right, you got $400,000 engineers who are sneaking away from work to go to this conference because they're that excited about it. And they're spending their precious time on the weekends building for it for free. And there's like 1,000 of them here at this one conference. It's like, all right, this this is happening. And so I decided I needed to go all in on Bitcoin. And I applied to be employee number one at Coinbase. Got turned down. So I was like, well, fuck this.
Happy or mad about that?
Yeah. Well, I don't know. Olaf did pretty well. I think Olaf got the title of employee number one. But no, so I just decided I'm just going to do my own thing. And I didn't really know what to do. But at this point in time, if you told someone that you were in Bitcoin, there was like 10 questions that every single person would ask. Well, what's Bitcoin? How does it work? Why does it have value? Why would I want to use that? What's Bitcoin mining? How do I store it? Where can I spend it? Like the same questions. And it was so annoying. You wanted to start lying to people, but not really, because you secretly want to evangelize it, you know? So we just made a magazine. We thought it was going to be a one-time thing called Why Bitcoin, that just went through and answered in the best possible way each of these questions. So if someone asks you, you can just be like, here's a magazine, leave me alone. And we got some great people to write articles for it. And it was really successful by accident. And so we got to do a second one. And then that became a third one, and then a fourth one. And then before we knew it, we were buying out the only other print publication, which was a total shit show, called Bitcoin Magazine. And then before we knew it, we were rolling up other media companies. And then, you know, we just kind of accidentally went from, hey, I'm going to do one print publication so people will stop asking me questions, to a portfolio of media companies all focused on Bitcoin and blockchain.
So did you pick up Bitcoin Magazine from Vitalik?
Mm-hmm. So that he could go do this wacky, crazy thing called Ethereum that we never thought was going to work. And
I'm not sure if it works yet.
Yeah, no. It's a very good point. But, you know, it did teach me a lesson that I'm not as smart as I think I am, because everybody was like, hey, you got to invest this 15 cents. You got to invest this 30 cents. Like, no, it's 90 cents. You got to get in. You got to get in. No, I'm not going to do it. It's $10. You got to get in. No, I'm not going to do it. Then, you know, 3 years later, it's $1,300. I'm like, I'm a fucking idiot. All right. Anyone in this industry who tells you that they know everything is full of shit. Right. They don't know. Because this is just history unfolding in front of us. You can be informed and you can have good principles that drive you. But how this all shakes out, who knows?
Right. And it's crazy because Bitcoin is like an expanding universe that reveals itself to us every day. Like, you're testing out the limits of the system.
Totally.
Every day, and sort of figuring out how we can work within that. And it's funny to see. That's why I'm excited to talk to you, how Bitcoin was marketed for a lot of the first decade, and how brushing out with some of the limitations of the network sort of really showed that some of those narratives and some of like the fast, easy, basically zero conf payment structure was the way Bitcoin was going to scale. Obviously, that's a term. We're talking about the machine payable web. I'm interested to see if you think Lightning sort of enables that vision more innately, because you're talking to somebody who owned a 21 computer and cool. was a part of the machine payable cool. web for a while. But yeah, like,
so that's how you know Andrew.
Yeah, that. Well, I know Andrew. I met Andrew in New York. Talking about Andrew DeSantis, I met him at Consensus here, but like 2 or 3 years ago.
We had
chatted on Twitter and decided to meet up with him to talk Bitcoin. He actually, yeah, that's where I first heard your name, was out of his mouth.
Oh.
He said, you got to find this man, David Bailey. He's a boss.
Hey, Andrew, if you're hearing this podcast, shout out to you. Long time no see.
Because he was at Bitcoin Magazine too, right?
He was. So, you know, we were, I guess at this point in time, like maybe 4 people. And then our current CTO, Tyler and Andrew, were at school still, and they started the Apple banned all Bitcoin wallets from the App Store. And so they created this like workaround where you could get Bitcoin wallets on your iPhone. I think they were calling it the Bit Store. That's the one thing about Bitcoin. No one knows how to fucking name anything. Everything's bit or block or so. It's like names are getting a lot better now than they used to back then, yeah. You know? And they got some money to get this going, went up to Toronto, burned all the money, came back. They're like, yo, we're out of money. Can we post up here for a little while? It's like, yes. Welcome to my web. All right. I didn't know really shit about technology, and both these guys are really good. So they were very instrumental in us getting, things rolling. And then, you know, as businesses grow up, things change. Tyler's still here. Andrew went on to 21, did some stuff with Balaji. was real hyped up on the 21 computer. So much promise and potential there. I always loved the like the deploy your own sensors and get paid as people ping your temperature data or whatever. I still think that's like a killer application.
Well, that's what I think this is enabled now with the Lightning Network. Maybe not on chain, but we're talking about Blockstream. I'm pretty sure with their satellite, they're enabling just what you're describing. Like if somebody wants to send weather information via the satellite, they can do it and charge basically like a stream of Lightning payments for that data.
Cool.
And so I guess, yeah, it's like going back to how the narrative has changed. Like,
This is a winding conversation.
Tales from the Crypt. There's no structure at all.
I'm starting to understand where the name comes from. All right. So, yeah. Cool. All right.
It's not Tales from the Crypto because I didn't want to be as obvious as you were just describing. Yeah. And Marty's Bent is just Marty's Bent because I don't want to have like an overt, like, this is the daily Bitcoin newsletter. But
thank you.
No, but like, so, and you're saying like you wish Bitcoin was almost like more like it was in the early days where people were more creative. And so how has the scene changed as more people come? I mean, it's inevitable. If we think Bitcoin's gonna become successful, more people are gonna come. But is are the newcomers sort of encroaching on the original vision in your mind?
So, you know, this is where I get in trouble saying things, and this is why I don't have a public profile. But you know, because we had a media company, we had to get advertising dollars. We had to have advertisers, all right? And this is a point in time where everyone's broke, so there's very few people who can advertise. And so literally I spent a year traveling around the world, going to meetups in Buenos Aires and Tel Aviv and Berlin and Hong Kong, et cetera, meeting all these different Bitcoin scenes. And so, you know, we met and interfaced with a lot of Bitcoin companies, probably more companies than any other organization out there in the crypto landscape. And so, like, I knew Jihan from Bitmain when it was four people and they had one guy who spoke really bad English selling miners from like a little foldable table about how they're going to bring mining back to the home and they were going to bring down the corrupt titans that were Butterfly Labs at the time and KNC Miner. And like, I knew Eric Voorhees when Eric was running, what's the dice game? Satoshi Dice. And
he made it like a bandit on that deal.
Well, the story may be more complicated than it appears on the surface, but I remember. Dude, I mean, just like all of these different communities, there were these different leaders that had kind of brought Bitcoin to that location. And it was amazing how even if you lived in Argentina or China or the United States, if you discovered Bitcoin, you were almost of this like meta society, like this like shared principles group. And like you got along perfectly. I mean, it was just like every conversation you had was like completely organic. Friendships developed. It was super cool. And so I know kind of the impetus and thesis and mindset that a lot of people who have ended up building successful businesses and then today are either hated or loved, we remember what it was like in their very, very early days. And these guys are hardcore Bitcoiners. I mean, they love Bitcoin. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's a little bit distressing to see someone who Jihan, I think, is like, for I'll use Jihan as an example here, but this applies to, I mean, literally 50 plus entrepreneurs, at least in the space. Jihan is like 29 years old, I believe, you know, translates the Bitcoin white paper when he is, I guess, 23 or 22, launches a mining company to take on the corrupt mining companies that existed at the time because they were like, almost every one of them was a scam, builds a company of 4,000 people. I mean, it's unbelievable. In 1 year, does billions in revenue. If they were in America, they'd be on the Fortune 500. And then you go on a crypto Twitter and it's like, yeah, fuck that guy. What has he ever done for Bitcoin? And it's like literally everything. He's dedicated his life to it. And so it's like, you know,
well, I'm one of those haters. I've said it many times on this podcast, not a hater. I do agree that Bitmain, we would not be as far along as we are, particularly with ASIC chips, as we are without Bitmain. But I've said that Bitmain is the Icarus story of early crypto, where they flew a little too close to the sun, thought their shit didn't stink, and sort of got reprimanded by Mother Bitcoin, who
They were the David versus Goliath, mm-hmm. and then they beat Goliath, unbelievably so, and then became Goliath, and then a new David shows up and beats Goliath, and it's like, yeah, fuck Goliath, you know, but it's just a cycle. And, you know, it's like, you know, with retrospect, everything seems so clear. But in the moment, in the time when everything's being made up kind of for the first time, people don't know. They don't know what's right and wrong. They don't know how things are going to shake out. So they just kind of... go with what feels right, I guess.
It goes back to what we were saying earlier. Like, Bitcoin is an expanding universe that's revealing itself to us. And I think, I mean, basically what we're beating around the bush here is the fork wars. And some people thought the Bitcoin universe was expanding and revealing information in a certain way and decided big blocks was the way and really stuck their flag in on that. And the market showed that, I mean, I would argue the market showed that probably isn't the best way to go forward. And like you said, they're on the wrong side of the debate now at this point. And it's like, but with that being said, like, I would love, I think of Roger in particular, because I feel bad for Roger. You look at Roger these days and he looks beaten, downtrodden. Like,
I mean, that was Bitcoin Jesus,
right?
I mean, he was going around the world evangelizing. he put every, I mean, literally, if you had an idea that could help Bitcoin, he would just fund you without a business model. Just go do it. Here's Bitcoin. Go.
All right.
And now he's Bitcoin Satan.
Bitcoin Judas, I think people
Bitcoin
call
Judas. Ooh.
Yeah, that's what people...
I like that.
I did
Bitcoin
not,
Judas.
I did not coin that one. Oh. But now it's... So that's my mindset here, is like long-term strategy. That's why I'm interested to talk to you, because BTC Media has been around for a while. I think Bitcoin Magazine, you guys have turned it into... what you've done with Aaron Van Weerdem and his writings and the Bitcoin focus over the years has been great. Some of the best information, the journalism around the fork wars in particular, Aaron sort sure. of describing what's going
Dude,
on.
Aaron's amazing.
And what's it like working with him?
Dude, you know, Aaron's a historian, and when we first started working with Aaron, he was coming over. He worked at Cointelegraph, and he was writing like the weekly
crypto
news roundup or something. And he was summarizing the little tidbits of stories for this shitty email they sent out. And what's amazing about Aaron, he's a smart guy, super cool guy, but he's a really good listener. And so he'll just listen, won't interrupt. He'll ask smart questions, and like, he actually cares about learning. And then because of that, developers like to talk to him, and so he learns from them, and then he just gets smarter all the time. It's like, he's just a super cool guy. Another person you should chat with. He's at a whole another world of Bitcoin and crypto that he's seen that I haven't seen.
Oh, I'm in his DMs. Don't worry. Aaron and I actually, I actually have corresponded with Aaron once. It was me, him, and Laurent from OXT.me and a dev from blockchain.info. Laurent, called for help on Twitter for people to come help him do research on the spam attacks over the summers of 2015, 2016.
Like, what was that company called that did it as a marketing stunt, which was pretty clever? I got.
I'm not sure I know the company.
There was like an exchange or something that like, we're like, we're going to stress test the blockchain and spammed it. It got so much marketing out of it.
They sent a bunch of dust transactions.
Yeah.
So Laurent sent out that like calling card, like, hey, anybody wants to like help me look up the spam attack, meet me in the Slack room. It was like me, Aaron, and Laurent. And I was like, that was my introduction, like personal introduction to Aaron. And Aaron, if you're listening, check your DMs. There's an invite to come on the podcast in there. But going back to like what I was getting at by bringing up Aaron is, I think Bitcoin Magazine, BTC Media in particular, has had a focus over the last 7 years that has really paid off for you guys.
I want to challenge that a little bit. You know, we have focus now. Mm-hmm. We haven't always had focus. And, you know, we should come back to this element, because Aaron plays a part of that story, that important role. But I want to hit something before we move on, which
hit
was
it.
the Roger, the Bitcoin Civil War. And I'm going to say something really controversial right here. People are sometimes wrong. Crazy.
Why would you ever say that?
Yeah. I mean, not everyone can be like the Twitterati and be 100% right about everything all the time. Not everyone has that amazing, magical, mystical ability. All right. So sometimes people can be wrong. And sometimes it takes people a long time to figure out that they're wrong. And when people figure out that they're wrong, they shouldn't have to eat a pile of dog shit to change their mind.
Right.
And I feel like, you know, in fact, I don't just feel like this. I know this. If he just wanted to say, hey, guys, I've learned a lot from all of this. I thought I got how it was all going to play out, but I was wrong. People would not accept that.
I would accept that. Good. So an example of somebody who did this is Wences Cesaris. He was on the wrong side of the fork wars. He came out after.
Has he been on the podcast? He's a cool dude.
He's not. Wences, I'm in your DMs as well if you're listening. Peep them.
Yeah.
No, but I do think, and I've said this all on this podcast before, like I would, like I'm not going to trust Roger. Like,
have you met Roger before?
I have not. Dwayne has.
Super cool dude.
Yeah.
Just don't fight him with karate. He'll fuck you up.
No jiu-jitsu.
Whoops. Yeah. Roger, if you heard that, please don't beat me up.
No, but I was like, I'm not gonna start a business with him. But it's like, hey, if you want to come back and like evangelize Bitcoin again, let's do it. And that's what I feel bad for Roger right now. Like I was saying, like I've seen, and I don't know him, so I don't know Roger. Maybe I shouldn't be talking about him. But it seems just like as an observer, as somebody who's been documenting and watching the progression of Bitcoin and the people within it, I think right now, like just using body language on YouTube videos, he seems like I'm wrong and I still gotta like go down this path, and he seems stubborn.
Roger's a very hard-headed person.
Yeah, stubborn man.
Yeah, he's stubborn, and
yeah,
which is a good thing and a bad thing, you know. It depends on, you know, the situation. But so, question for you: if you were hanging out with Roger and y'all took a selfie and you post it on your Twitter,
I'd get hate.
You get hate.
Yeah.
That's crazy.
I know.
That's crazy.
I'm also a kid from Philly and I don't give a fuck.
Yeah.
So
perfect. So that's the type of corrosiveness that we don't need, because that is not productive.
Well, that's a funny point to bring up, because the corrosiveness, it's probably stems because Bitcoin is money and people get really emotional when people try to fuck with their money. So that's what I think, like, a lot of the hate is, like, don't fuck with my money is like a lot of people saw Bitcoin Cash as an attack on their money. And
sure, that's fair.
Mm-hmm.
But that's not an individual person to hate, you know.
No.
Don't hate the player, hate the game, so to speak, you know. So you can be upset about a controversial fork, and that's legitimate, but you shouldn't put yourself in a position where you personally dislike someone to the degree where you're not even allowed to be around them. Like, that's how we ended up in the situation where someone who loves Bitcoin, who has a tiny disagreement, becomes radicalized into the, what did Jihan tweet? Fuck your mother, fuck.
Fuck your mother if you want to fuck.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. Like, you know, I wish I'd been there that night that he posted that. I'm curious what the circumstances were around it. But, I mean, that's like radicalization. And that comes from just like getting hit from too many sides. And like, you know, then blood's on both sides. And
well,
then people are feuding over the things that are different than what the original fight was over.
I completely agree with you. And it's like we can analogize this to like leftist politics today. If you don't fall within like the certain Venn diagram of everybody, you are outcasted.
Yes. And we cannot eat our own.
Right.
Like, we cannot. I mean, yes, exactly. And it's like there's this virtue signaling that goes on in the space where, you know, if you are the most righteous, you know, purest Bitcoiner, then, you know, somehow that entitles you to Twitter fame. And it's bullshit.
I'm probably guilty of this. I'm definitely guilty of this. I've definitely clout chased on Twitter for righteousness, definitely, in the past.
I thought you were from Philly. That you didn't care about this stuff.
No, but it's you do feel a little pressure. Like, hey, let me signal that.
You know, I saw the biggest virtue signal campaign the other day that agitated me to the point where I actually tweeted something, and I only typically just show my own stuff on Twitter, so I don't tweet things I actually think. But the this rollback that was so controversial.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like, God forbid that we describe a feature of Bitcoin as it works rather than all of us just pretending that that's not how it works, because pretending makes it real somehow. I don't know. It's like people know that there's such a thing as orphaned blocks.
Mm-hmm.
And that there's just that naturally effectively occurs in Bitcoin, less so now, but formerly all the time. Like, there's a reason we wait for 6 confirmations before we accept a transaction. Like, when did that become a moral thing with, if you wait for 6 confirmations or, you know, 3 confirmations is like, fuck you if you wait for 3. I don't know.
You know, it's within the limits of proof of work, right? Like, it is technically possible.
Yes. And so, like, maybe there's now, if you calculate the math, it becomes astronomically absurd to roll back anything significant. But, like, maybe if Coinbase got hacked one day and 10% of all Bitcoins were stolen, there's a formula that someone could run that says, maybe it's worth bribing miners to roll back 3 blocks so that we could save 10% of all Bitcoin. And the math works. Like, we shouldn't hate that that's a thing that happens.
And that could happen.
Yeah, it could happen. And it should. There's nothing wrong with that happening in that circumstance. If it's economically viable to do, it should be done. Like, if there's an attack vector against Bitcoin that can be attacked, people should attack it. Bitcoin doesn't survive because of people's virtue signaling. Like, if we required virtue signaling for Bitcoin, we would not be here today. Bitcoin would be done. So, you know, it's just all these people on their high horse, and it's like turning all this stuff into moral issues. And it's like, guys, we're building a technology. We're trying to change the world. We don't have to virtue signal about how much we care about decentralization. We're building a decentralized financial system. That should be enough virtue signaling for everyone.
Right? Just the mere participation.
Yeah.
No, but it is. Again, like, I'm definitely not intense apart, but like, I am on Twitter, like, trying to add to the conversation and stuff. And you can feel it. Like, there is definitely a competition of thought, a thought competition, if you will. But I do want to stress, like we said earlier, we do not want to become like the hardcore radical left here in the States where you have to agree with 8,000 things or you're not within the party lines and you get tossed out.
We need to be a positive, forward-looking, inspiring community, and we need to ignore dumb ideas. You know, if every dumb idea you heard required a reaction to it, you would spend all day just responding to dumb ideas.
That's what I interviewed Andrew Torba from Gab last weekend, and that's like what we dove into. Is like, if you don't like something, mute it, like block it, just don't listen to it, unfollow. And it seems like people in this day and age don't have that ability to ignore. They need to be outraged. Outrage culture is a thing.
Outrage culture is such a, totally, and it pisses me off. I'm outraged about it.
It goes back to this disconnection from reality, right? The virtue signaling has more merit than merit today, right? And then logic and the truth, right? We live in a world that, again, is disconnected from reality. Again, going back to like the leftist party lines, I would argue that a lot of it is impossible to fall within all those sort of baskets. And it's a virtue signal to basically make sure everybody's feelings are okay.
It's an attempt to create a new hierarchy. Mm-hmm. That's ranked by the purist as determined by the mob. And that's not a good spot to be in. I'm just saying that's historically we have a good track record of that being a bad thing to do. So, but I'll get off my soapbox on it. But, you know, I feel like we're one of the few companies that can say all this with some credibility, because we saw a different time when there wasn't this dynamic, and, you know, crypto Twitter wasn't a thing. And, you know, we saw people for who they were and what they wanted to build and what inspired them. And dude, there are some really cool people out there who have just been completely pushed away from Bitcoin. You know, Eric Voorhees, I don't know if you follow Eric Voorhees or if you read his blog, I think it's called Money and State. Eric Voorhees is a poet. Like he is.
He helped red pill me when I was first getting in, like reading his stuff about it. No, it's like Eric, again, is another character that causes much contention.
Stephen Pair. All right, I shouldn't be just naming people because if people hear this, they're going to be like, why'd you call me out? But like Stephen Pair, like if I had to like name like five people that have affected my thinking and inspired me to be in the space, Stephen Pair is one of them. He one time told me that the only thing that matters is that you acquire as much Bitcoin as you possibly can right now, because it's 1/21 millionth of everything. And it doesn't matter how much money your business makes, it can't exceed owning a fraction of 1/21 millionth of everything. And it's like, all right, that's a Bitcoin bull maximalist, if you've ever heard one.
That's a Chad right there.
Yeah. And now it's like, you know, talk to Steven and he's like, yeah, I don't know how I feel about Bitcoin anymore. All these people, they're so angry. And it's like, dude, you just...
Is Bitcoin socially scalable? Is it going to get to a point where too many people are clout chasing and it just becomes untenable because it's just not socially coordinatable?
Well, this is the thing. Bitcoin doesn't care.
Right.
So, you know, like everything, it's about separating, you know, signal from noise. Crypto Twitter is just all noise. It's just noise all the time. You know, Bitcoin does not give a fuck what you say on Twitter.
Thank God. Doesn't even know that Twitter exists.
Yes. Thank God. So, anyway.
How can we fix the discourse? What do you think needs to happen?
Well, so I guess this is part maybe where we can get into the story I was just mentioning about why Bitcoin Magazine can't say that it's been purely focused on Bitcoin. You know, as we've seen all of these waves come and go, you know, for a long time, I've considered myself not a Bitcoin maximalist, but a Bitcoin maximizer. All right, which means make as much Bitcoin as you possibly can. That is the real message of Bitcoin. All right, just go and be a pirate, make as much Bitcoin as you possibly can. So, you know, we're opportunists with our business in terms of seeing where the market is, seeing where there's business opportunities, seeing where the market is willing to spend money, and then providing a product or a service that makes us money. I want to apologize to everyone who's hearing this that we're a business and we try to make money. I hope everyone's okay with that. And so, you know, we have kind of, I guess, wandered through Token Forest and like been there and wandered back out. And, you know, I mean, dude, we have our hands in a lot of stuff. I guess, you know, this, we're low key because we don't want people to know all of the things that we're involved in or, connected to necessarily, but like we own, for example, 1/3 of the biggest ICO platform in the world in China before it was shut down by the Chinese government.
What was this?
This was in 2017 that it was shut down.
Mm-hmm.
And it was called ICO Age. It's the most profitable business I've ever seen in my entire life. It was what a great business. But the and like, you know, we, you know, this suite is paid for. Well, maybe I shouldn't say who it's paid for, but the in the room beside us are several of the Ethereum co-founders. All right. Like we've been there. We've seen all this stuff. We've been a part of the genesis of a lot of this stuff. And, you know, we're open-minded people who are saying, like, if you can build something cool on blockchain or if there's a permissioned blockchain application that someone makes that works and like creates value, like show it to us and like we'd love to see it, because you know, Godspeed, so to speak. But after a certain amount of time goes by and you don't see it, you start becoming a little disillusioned. And then, you know, when crypto winter comes, which it always comes, it forces you to look at what your priorities are, both personally, professionally, as a business, et cetera. And so, you know, there was a point in time like last year in 2017, God, 2017 was such a good year, 2018, where we hit basically 90 employees. We were spread out across, I don't know, 10 businesses. Maybe it's more or less than that. I don't know. Some of them were blockchain focused. Some of them were token focused. You know, and when winter came and business is hard, you know, business requires focus to be successful. And so, like, you know, when things are, everything's going up, it's very easy to paper over all of your problems by just throwing money at it, which is the worst thing you can do, but it's the easiest thing in the moment. And then when things are going bad, not only is everything going bad all at once, but things that could be salvageable become not salvageable because you have no attention or time to give it, which a real business, you hunker down and you give it the time and attention and then you survive. And, you know, being successful in Bitcoin is all about surviving winters. Like, that's just survival is the name of the game. And it's just hard to, like, if we say this a lot now at the office, but if everything's a priority, then nothing's a priority. Mm-hmm. So, you know, there was a period in time where we were doing a lot of stuff and outside of Bitcoin, and about, I guess, 8 months ago, what, it's May right now. So maybe 9-10 months ago, we were like, this is not fun. We're not having fun. We're losing a ton of money every month. We are dealing with fire after fire after fire. We have half of our time being diverted to projects that we really have no confidence that they're anything more than a science experiment. It's like, why? Why are we doing that? And Aaron Von Wordham came in and sat down with me and was like, David, I know you're excited about all of these things that we're doing, but I think you're missing the biggest kind of gap in the market, which is no one's focused on Bitcoin, like BTC. And I think that if we shifted and changed our business, that there's actually a big market segment out there for us to go and pursue. And so it's like, you know, that opportunity kind of snuck out of nowhere, because when we got started, everyone was Bitcoin. And then just everyone became Bitcoin and then some. And then slowly over time, you became, you know, the minority of your content was Bitcoin, because there's so much noise being created at all these different places. And then before you know it, like, Bitcoin's like the minority thing that you're talking. And it wasn't an intentional decision. It just like organically evolved. And so we looked at that and we're like, you know what? Fuck all this other stuff that we're doing. Let's just focus on what we love, what's proven, and where we can have fun. And like, damn, if we wouldn't live with a lot of regret, if we were so spread thin that we picked the right technology, the right play, the right time, and didn't make any money because we just spread ourselves too thin, versus if we like gave it our all, knew that we left everything on the field, so to speak, and it just happened not to be Bitcoin that was the winner. Like, I'd be much more okay with the second option than the first option. And so we reflected on this for a while, and then it became kind of like, once you kind of, we've got our mindset to like, no more bullshit, focus on fun, wide open Bitcoin opportunity, it became unignorable. Like, every time we're having a conversation about anything that's not Bitcoin, it's like, wow, this is all just a sunk cost. Like, let's just stop talking about this topic and just shift gears. And so we've really had a total mind shift change in our business. And so I would say Bitcoin has only, Bitcoin Magazine was pure Bitcoin from, I guess, 2011 to, let's say, 2014, 2015. Then it slowly started getting infiltrated with non-Bitcoin stuff. I'm not going to call it bullshit, but just, you know, science experiments, let's say. And then about 6 months ago, only Bitcoin again, like completely focused on Bitcoin across the entire business, but especially at Bitcoin Magazine. And God, it's been so much better.
Has it?
So much better.
What's changed mostly?
Dude, first off, just the attitude at the office, the cultural attitude at the office, where it's like, it's very hard to really like feel natural in a role when you're having to wear a lot of different, I'm not going to call them different faces, but when you're having to have a voice for this and a voice for that versus when you have one voice, you're focused on one thing and you truly authentically believe in it. Like, it becomes so much easier to talk about what you want to do. You know, product strategy becomes so much clearer because you're just building something that you would want to see for yourself. Like, it's just, it's a lot more fun to come into the office, and a lot more people at our company know what they should be doing because it's much clearer what the vision is than spread across a whole bunch of stuff that people are, you know, if the bull market's here, yay, you've made money. But it's, you know, when the bear market's here, it's like, oh, you've lost money and you don't fucking believe in the shit. I mean, so.
No, as a Bitcoiner, like, I'm fucking pumped that you guys have refocused. And when I said earlier that you guys have been focused throughout the years, I do think your Bitcoin coverage has been some of the best still throughout the years.
Totally.
Describing how Segway works, describing what was going on with Fork Wars. Aaron does an incredible job of explaining technical details. Totally.
You know, one of my proudest articles that we have is our guide on how to claim your Bitcoin Cash and sell it.
Mm-hmm.
That's the best performing article we've ever written.
Really?
Ever. And I don't know how many hundreds of thousands of people we helped safely sell their Bitcoin Cash.
Thank you for your service.
Yeah. You're welcome. Thank Aaron. He did the hard work.
No, but it's something, because we were talking about, like, old heads in the space. You're looking at Coinbase now, they're spinning out basically a shitcoin casino. They're doing custody, they're doing staking. They seem like a company in my mind that's spreading themselves too thin, and it might be hurting them in the long run.
Every company in the space has to learn the lesson that we learned, or they will learn it eventually at a higher cost. Like, it's not a unique story to us. And, you know, whenever you say shitcoin casino, you know, whenever you look at a shitcoin casino, you should always just ask yourself, if you're trying to determine if someone is helping or hurting Bitcoin, what do they count their profits in? And if at the end of the day, they're counting how much Bitcoin they have, they're helping Bitcoin.
Mm-hmm.
So I can tell you that Coinbase, Brian, that crew, they count Bitcoin.
Do they? Yeah.
Dude, I can tell you they're not counting it in USDC or whatever it is.
I figured that I see them trending more towards like Ethereum. Like, I thought,
dude,
trying to make Toshi.
Most of the Ethereum co-founders count their profits in Bitcoin.
Right.
I mean, it's the gosh, shoot, maybe this will get me in trouble. The
I like trouble.
You know, it's Bitcoin maximization.
It's the mother. Yeah. We're maximizing Bitcoin, but it is, it proves that everything's priced in Bitcoin. Like, it all comes back to Bitcoin at the end of the day. But I also do think, like, the altcoins and the shitcoin casinos, if you will, do provide almost like an aurora of security, because it confuses the authorities and people who could sort of choke Bitcoin if it was standing by itself and was very obvious that that was going to take on the world financial system, whereas now you have thousands of coins where it's like, oh, maybe it could be another one. Maybe we shouldn't worry about it yet.
Yeah.
It provides like a little bit of cover.
And we should thank all those ICOs marketing budgets for bringing so many people to crypto. All right. Because they'll come to Bitcoin eventually. They'll find it eventually.
Right.
Bitcoin, it has a natural gravity. Like, you will use Bitcoin. Every person hearing this podcast, if they're not already using it, will eventually use it. You don't have a choice. Like, it will force you.
Do you think it's inevitable?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely.
Why is that?
Because the world needs something like Bitcoin. And I have yet to see one person propose a way to actually improve over the Bitcoin mechanisms. And like, if you go on, there's actually a great Bitcoin talk thread about this. Like, the places in which you can innovate around Bitcoin, the distribution of the tokens, or I don't remember all the different vectors. There's only a couple that you can tweak around, and no one has come up with anything yet that's better.
Yeah, you try to make block times faster, more TPS. Like, it's all vanity metrics. Yeah, it looks better on paper, but then you go and you look at the amount of hash power needed to
get an equal amount of security that six Bitcoin confirmations has, and nobody's even close. Like Ethereum's second, but it's still, you need 5x the time to get the same confirmation that your transaction is buried in the blockchain.
Totally.
And
there's no free lunch.
No. And it's been fun going on this ride. It's been fun being a pirate, like you described earlier. I like that. I want to refer to myself as a pirate more. I think I'm going to start doing that, freak. So I'm Marty the pirate now.
There's a pirate code. All right. So there's still some rules of the sea. But, you know, you commandeer ships when it makes sense. And you make people walk the plank when it makes sense. But otherwise, you just drink a lot and you count your doubloons and chase tail.
What's it? But what's it like being a pirate, right? Because it was taboo to be in Bitcoin, like you were describing earlier. Like, how has the perception of your family and extended friends changed?
It's totally changed. This is also one of the conclusions that we came to when we were talking. So, all right, let me take a step back. So, when we made the change to focus only on Bitcoin, we did a blog post. We announced the change. It was called "Make Bitcoin Fun Again." And so the reason why we made it titled it that, not because we're trying to channel Trump, but because, if we're going to be focused on Bitcoin full time, we have to have fun doing it. And when we looked at the Bitcoin landscape, when we were like, all right, if we were all full time Bitcoin, what would it be like? Dude, it's not fun like it used to be fun. Like there used to be like memes. And we used to put fucking dogs' faces on NASCARs and make people watch it on television. And, you know, we used to pay people to blow up their iPhones. I mean, like, that was fun, you know. So it was like, all right, if we're going to do this full time, we have to bring back the fun. Now I'm lost track of where I am.
How's the perception changed?
All right. So, you know, when Bitcoin was young, it was completely seen as illegitimate. You were a psycho if you were involved in it. And so you really had nothing to lose by being kind of, you know, outspoken about kind of controversial ideas. Then as Bitcoin gained legitimacy, you saw this shift where everybody was like, let's go fucking buy suits. And we are almost there where like big banks will get Bitcoin and we can really prove to people that this is a real thing. And like, you just got to appreciate that at the time we're all wanting Bitcoin to succeed. So that seems like the thing that can be done to like help it. And then now we're so legitimate that really the industry should be pivoting all the way back to the beginning of like, fuck you. We don't need to impress you anymore. Like we already created $100 billion thing on the way to a $10 trillion thing on the way to even beyond. And so fuck you. Like this is what Bitcoin is. If you don't like it, go away.
Well, no, I completely agree. And I think we try to make things weird here at Tales from the Crypt, Marty's Bent. We try to bring back a little bit of weirdness. And I wish I was around to experience the weirdness the early days that you did. But no, I agree. I have a sort of fuck you, this is inevitable mindset, especially in my writing and on this podcast. And I think for me personally, my journey, like I'm still getting shit from my parents. My parents are more onto it. Not even my in-laws, but like my cousins, friends, like, oh, you're crazy. You're still that crazy Bitcoin friend. But I'm like, yeah, you guys are going to be, I'm going to be laughing at you in a few years. Not laughing at you, but you're going to be.
My mom, who's 60 years old. Well, she's not 60. She's 35 years old. She runs our back office now at our company.
Boss.
She saw this. She was like, this is crazy. First time she saw me get paid by a customer in Sweden and the transaction cleared zero fee. And the cash was in deposit in our bank account. She's like, holy shit, this works. This is way better than credit cards. And so, yeah, dude, it's like people think they'll never. It's like what you were saying earlier with iPhones. People are like, oh, old people will never get smartphones. And then it turns out they want to communicate with people. They figure it out. They start using smartphones. So, dude, it's you don't have a choice. Those who wait last to convert to Bitcoin will be impoverished by Bitcoin.
Whoa. Paul, a powerful quote.
The Paul Krugmans of the world, that's the greatest irony of it all.
Right?
That's the greatest irony of it all. They're the last bag holders of all the paper monopoly money.
And they're going to cling to their ideas that they need to be
need to be right.
I can't wait to go to the yard sale for Paul Krugman. Go pick, rummage through all his like prized possessions. Be like, I'll pay you a Satoshi for that.
I'll give you
Satoshi for that. Yeah,
I'll give you 100 Satoshis for your Nobel Prize.
What's the smelt value of this? Oh man. So yeah, I think it's an inevitability. It's just like, it's just time playing out, and that's all it is. Like, and you know, it's water running down a mountain. So we, you know, we give ourselves too much credit when we say like, oh, we're building this thing, because it's like, all right, the water's gonna make it down to the bottom of the mountain, regardless of whatever you do. But we are channeling the path of the water as it flows down. Mm-hmm. So that's still cool. That's still cool.
No, it is. And it's cool to be a part of, because it's completely emergent, right? Like, we were talking about like Bitcoin, the system of node operators and miners and devs is emergent, like physically working on the system and making it work as a technical project. But then beyond that, it's like the people like the Bitcoin magazines, Tales from the Crypt just pop up out of nowhere. Like, we need this thing to succeed, and they need us like to talk about it.
Totally.
To spread the word.
Totally. And, I mean, the you know, Bitcoin is as inevitable as the internet is. They're one and the same. They're like the same. They're, it's the digitization of all things. And so, like, you know, when people, like, I still hear, there's only, I guess, a small list of things that people think will break Bitcoin. One of them is like, if there's a critical flaw found in Bitcoin and somehow we're able to just mint a whole bunch of Bitcoins, that's the death of Bitcoin. No, it's not. Like, that's like saying if the internet, there was a flaw in the internet, and the internet went down for 2 weeks, that the internet's gone forever.
We're never going to use it again.
Yeah. It's like, no, we depend upon it. Like, we need it in human society to move on. We have to have it. And so we're going to figure out what broke. We'll fix it. We'll redeploy it, and it'll work again. Same with Bitcoin.
That's the beauty of Bitcoin too. It amends itself every 10 minutes. So you can have it right up to the moment that it fucked up and go back to that.
That's right. That's right. You know, and I will, I guess to kind of go back to what we were talking about a little while ago, one thing I didn't mention about the Civil War that happened. Dude, we're constantly learning new things. I mean, like, I'm constantly being impressed by Bitcoin, seeing things I never saw saw beforehand. And, you know, I feel like we learned something from that Civil War, and we should spend time to reflect on what did we learn. So that people can say, okay, we fought this battle, we learned this lesson, and we don't have to fight the same battle again to learn the same lesson in the future. Like, we should like record these lessons somewhere so that, you know, we can memorialize them. I don't know.
Well, they're recorded on Bitcoin Magazine.
That's right.
The Path to Segwit.
That's right. That's right. You know, the I think like what we learned from that is that Bitcoin on layer one, its principles cannot change, and that forks don't fly. And so, like, that's what we learned. I don't think we learned, there's other lessons that people think we learned. I don't think we necessarily learned them, but like, forks are no good. Doesn't matter if you like big blocks, doesn't matter what your opinion is about it. Bitcoin doesn't care about your opinion. Forks won't work. So you have to deal with the system as it is, and then you have to figure out to how to work with those pieces to create the thing that you ultimately want to create. And so, like, if you look at math and the very tight rules that math has and arithmetic has, if you're trying to achieve some formula and the formula doesn't work out, you don't go and you change the rules of math. You don't go change the rules of arithmetic so that you can get your, you know, thermodynamic, aerodynamic formula to work. No, that's stupid. You have to come up with a new creative approach to solve the original problem that you're trying to solve. That's what's so cool about Lightning Network. It's like, if Lightning Network would not be where it is, if there wasn't all this pressure building to find a solution for, you know, people to use every day.
Yeah, no, and it's, that was beautifully said. Like, it's like Lightning, things like Liquid. I'm not sure how confident I am about either, really, but they are like, just, I'm actually fairly confident about both, but it's just, again, the market finding solutions to the problem. The problem being that Bitcoin has certain limitations at the protocol level, and all we needed to do is be slow, dumb, and stupid, and create blocks roughly every 10 minutes in a distributed fashion, and we'll be Gucci.
and just figuring out how to leverage those assurances on top of that protocol layer. But it's crazy. This is an alien technology. Like, we're learning how it works. Again, going back, we're learning how it works. And I think you're making me more of a soft-hearted Bitcoiner throughout this conversation. We need to have more. What's the word? We need to let people down later who have ill-conceived notions that turn out
we're
to be
wrong,
false.
Because Who knows what day you'll be wrong? You know,
I'm wrong a lot.
So we'll pivot this conversation a little bit to the present. Mm-hmm. If you're feeling a little soft-hearted, we're having a conference. Bitcoin 2019.
Oh, I'll be there. We're going to be recording a live podcast there.
Dope. Cool. Biggest Bitcoin conference in the world. Biggest Bitcoin conference actually since Bitcoin 2014. We were hoping that we could make the claim biggest Bitcoin conference ever, but we're not quite there yet. We're not quite there.
Use the promo code RHR and help us get there.
Good shilling. You know, we've gone out on a limb and invited some of these nasty characters that everyone's so mad about.
People are not happy Jihan's going to be there.
It's a constant negotiation with Jihan. He may not be there, so people may get their whim. We'll see. Wow. He's a little bit...
preoccupied?
Yeah. Also a little nervous. Just feels like there's a lot of hate. But there is a lot of people... who, you know, maybe people have been upset about that are going to be there at the event. They're only going to be talking about BTC, no BCH bullshit, no big blocks, no, this is how we need to fix Bitcoin and make it work. It's like, all right, all of that doesn't matter. Let's just talk about BTC. And we're going to give them a platform to be involved in the community. And so this is a good place to like meet these people and like have a human relationship with them and like figure out what drives them. And, you know, if Roger wants to come to the event, Roger is more than welcomed at the event. As long as he's not, you know, saying BCH is the real Bitcoin. He's more than welcome at the event. And it's going to be a super cool moment where I think we can change the conversation of like big block Bitcoin versus small block Bitcoin or whatever to Bitcoin versus the world. All right. And we're like all on the same team to take on the world and to transform that. And like we have minute disagreements. The one thing we all know is that forks don't work anymore. So don't even try to come pitch your fork. And outside of that, build whatever you can build to create value and grow this virus faster so that we can get rid of the bullshit legacy system that exists today. Like that's what we're all fighting against, is like replacing the old redundant system that's holding back society, humanity, all the people of the planet.
Wow. No, I love it. Thank you for putting it together with that mindset in mind. Like, hey, let's shake hands, get back. Because Rod and I have been talking about people. Rod and I got drinks a couple months ago and brought up the Jihan thing. Like, yeah, people saw Jihan on the site. Like, but it's like, like you said earlier, like he was at Bitcoin San Jose 2014, like with the
Jihan, people don't even know this. There are multiple Bitcoin core devs that he gives money to for them to just do their work. And they're like BTC core devs. And they can't tell the world that they give the money because everyone would immediately be like, oh, these are just Bitmain shills trying to take down Bitcoin. But these are Bitcoin core developers that you know that are super well respected, and Bitmain in private supports them just so that they can work on Bitcoin because they fucking love Bitcoin.
Well, thank you, Jihan.
So
I guess the message of this podcast is give peace a chance.
Give peace a chance, right. and have fun. Just focus on having fun. If we all have fun and we get away from the outrage, if we could create outrage culture. If we could create like a fun rage culture.
Ooh. Yeah. I was an underager back in my day.
Yeah. So I think we would all get along a lot better. So we have shit like we're going to have Venezuelan fiat that we're trying to figure out right now how we can make it rain from the ceiling if you tip a QR code, make it so that the speakers, you know, they're trying to be all serious and shit. It's like Venezuelan, you know, monopoly money coming down on them. We got Bitcoin arcade games. We have an art gallery where we have like Bitcoin puzzles hidden in the art. We have three people at our company right now working on launching a Game Boy, classic Game Boy game. Find Bitcoin, get, make it to Bitcoin 2019 Game Boy game, where people can discover free tickets and talk to Bitcoin characters within the Game Boy game. Like, this is the ridiculous things that we're working on. This is what I mean by, like, make Bitcoin fun again. Focus on, like, enjoying life and less on, like, being upset about what other people are doing.
Because at the end of the day, it doesn't matter, right?
It doesn't matter. No. It doesn't matter. Bitcoin is going to do Bitcoin. It's going to do Bitcoin. It doesn't care.
It doesn't. God, I love this conversation. Thank you for putting this together, Rod. No, David, like I said, like, you are somebody who's been whispered into my ears a few times throughout the years, like, you should meet this guy, and I'm very happy that I have. I've heard a lot about the fun that you have down in Tennessee as well. What do you do outside of Bitcoin? Like, what interests you outside of Bitcoin?
Basically nothing. Basically just do Bitcoin literally all day, every day. I get off of work, and I go home, and I get on our Bitcoin, or, you know, I do Bitcoin all day, every day. Honestly, Bitcoin consumes my life entirely. But in Nashville, we do have a lot of fun. Bachelorette capital of the United States.
Mm-hmm.
Now it's become number two for bachelor party in the United States because they follow the bachelorette parties.
I was at one last year.
Cool. And, you know, I would say, I don't know, Nashville is basically as hot as layer two scaling solutions.
Yeah. Yeah. Your boy Rod's been selling Nashville hard.
And the cost of living is way lower, so if you're trying to stack sats, it's a good place to do it.
Williamsburg, Brooklyn is not the best place to stack sacks if you're stack sats.
Hey, man, that's Ethereum town.
Oh, believe me, I'm in the belly of the beast.
Belly of the beast.
It's,
hey, Joe, another guy who counts it in Bitcoin.
They all do. They all do. It's the mother.
Yeah. It's the reserve currency of crypto.
It's the reserve currency of the other projects. Well, I don't want to take up too much of your time, Davis.
This is good.
It's been an incredible
hour. I'm feeling pretty buzzed after, I don't know how much of this whiskey we've drank, but it's the whole bottle. Wow.
Between the four of us, finished the bottle. Yeah,
nice.
Are you you big whiskey guy?
You know, I live in, I grew up on a farm in Lincoln County, Tennessee, which is about 15 minutes away from the Jack Daniel's distillery. So dry county. Never drank a drop in my life until I was 21, of course. I'm just kidding. I drink alcohol all the time. Yeah, no. If you work in crypto, you have to drink heavily. I mean, that's the name of the game. That's the name of the game.
Especially this week.
Yes. Well, it depends on the season. You either drink to drown your sorrows or you drink to party, you know? It depends on the Bitcoin price.
I went to dinner on Saturday night with a bunch of Bitcoiners when the price was breaching 7,000. Like, $7,350. It was a fun dinner, needless to say. Got a little rowdy.
It's a drug. You just can't escape it.
It is. It's the worst addiction. There's a gravity to it. There's a virus. Like, it is a mind virus. Like, why has it infected us so bad? Like, is it because it's so obvious?
It's a black hole of all value. Just sucks all things into it, and it won't stop.
Are we crazy?
You know, if it wasn't that the fact that Bitcoin was a $100 billion project, I'd say yes. But the price tells me we're not crazy.
Mm-hmm.
Or otherwise it wouldn't have gotten to where it's gotten. It's the rest of the world that's fucking crazy and they're just now figuring it out.
Right? But I have to pinch myself every once in a while. Like, are you fucking crazy, Marty?
Well, I've come to the conclusion that one Bitcoin is 1/21 millionth of all the energy in the universe. And if that's not crazy, I don't know what is.
Fuck. Oh. Are we going down Dyson sphere conversation
right
now?
I'm the ultimate Bitcoin bull. What time is it? How long have we talked on this?
We're an hour and a half in right now.
All right. So I'm going to leave on this note. All right. So if you told someone that in 1994, that there's this thing being built called the internet, and that one day it will exceed the amount of information ever created in human history, including every handwritten letter, every fax, every telegram, every piece of art, every book ever published, that it would exceed the aggregate information of all of those things, people would think you're fucking crazy. Now the internet creates that much information every second. Every second. The value of Bitcoin you know, people want to prescribe, oh, if it reaches the size of equities or the size of derivatives, or if it hits this size or this size, that's as stupid as fucking saying that that fucking the value of email is the value of the U.S. postal system. Like, Bitcoin will create more value in a second, 30 years from now, than the aggregate amount of value that's been created thus far in human history to this date. Like, this thing is a fucking black hole, and it's going to get fucking crazy. It's just the very, very, very beginning of it right now.
I think I got to go buy more Bitcoin. David, I can't thank you enough for...
Yeah, thank you for having me.
No, well, you have me in your room, so thank you for having me. This has been a pleasant conversation. I'm very, very happy to have met the man that I've heard whispers about throughout the years.
Cool. Roll Tide.
Peace and love, freaks. Begin!